my career emerged from tragedy. Probably but for 9/11 and but for Bali, I wouldn't have seen as much of Prime Minister Howard. I probably wouldn't have been sent to Washington. So you've got to recognise where the luck comes in. In the lead up to the 1972 election, Dick Woolcott, who was then my branch head in foreign affairs, came around and said, look, the Prime Minister is speaking at the National Press Club today. He's phoned me up for a game of squash. I've got commitments which I can't get out of. Do you have your squash gear with you? So I had to quickly go home, change T-shirts. I arrived a little bit late. Prime Minister was a little bit annoyed, but he soon got over that. It was certainly better than turning up with an It's Time T-shirt.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Dennis Richardson has just retired after an illustrious public service career. He served, among many other positions, in a high level in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, as Secretary of the Foreign Affairs and Defence Departments, as head of ASIO, and as ambassador to Washington. Way back when, he was also chief of staff to then Prime Minister Bob Hawke. Dennis Richardson, of the diverse jobs that you've had, which has been the most challenging?
Well, the most challenging was immediately following 9/11 and Bali. I was in ASIO from 1996 to 2005. We had the Olympics, which was a challenge in its own right, but 9/11 and Bali elevated terrorism to the centre of public policy priorities. We had to, in a three and a half year period, almost double the size of ASIO. We went from 9 to 5 to 24/7, and in addition, we had to meet the challenges thrown at us by 9/11 and by Bali.
And was this a transformation of the nature of the security threat? Was that the main thing as well as more work?
The transformation had started prior to that. One advantage we had was that the lead up to the Sydney Olympics forced a reprioritisation of work away from counterintelligence into counterterrorism.
And of all these jobs, which was the most interesting?
Well, quite frankly, all my jobs have been really interesting, really, really interesting. Washington, for instance, is a job which, regardless of how demanding it is, and sometimes it is demanding, it is always enjoyable. You constantly find yourself in Washington in situations where you say to yourself, I'd actually do this for nothing, and you're getting paid for it. Head of DFAT, well, I joined the then Department of External Affairs as a graduate, and if you join anywhere as a graduate to head up the organisation you joined at age 21... is something quite special. Prime Minister and Cabinet, that period is probably, I think, where I learnt a heck of a lot, which I was able to take forward. And then defence was surprisingly enjoyable. I was there for 4.5 years. I'd worked around defence and with defence for a long time, but curiosity and challenge led me to that job, and I was pleased that I did it.
Just going back to the Washington job, is it difficult to be an outsider in a system having been very much on the inside? In other words, the information doesn't come to you automatically. Mm. You don't have the same position to just demand information as in your own system.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, that is one of the challenges of your job, simply because you have an alliance relationship with the United States and you have a close relationship in every other way with the US. That doesn't mean that access is automatic. It's something that people forget. People assume that access in Washington is easy. The problem is that there's about 183, 185 countries with representatives in Washington. They're all demanding access to what is a relatively small group of people. Add to that the way the US system works. All your major corporations, not only within the US but sometimes elsewhere around the world, have representatives in Washington. Add to that your domestic politics, and it's a relatively small group of people in respect of whom the whole world is knocking at the door, and you've got to compete against that. However, having worked elsewhere overseas when I'd been previously in foreign affairs, at least that gave me some understanding of it. I never assumed when I went to Washington that the access would be automatic, even though I've got to say the people I knew before I went there, particularly in the intelligence community in the US, they were very welcoming.
So Joe Hockey at the moment must have a pretty difficult job.
Joe's got the advantage of being, as did Kim Beazley, of being a politician.
And that helps?
It doesn't. There's no automaticity to it in terms of the administration, but it does help when it comes to the Congress. I think globally, those who are elected or have been elected have an affinity with each other, which an unelected official does not have. So it would help Joe in terms of the Congress, but it would not necessarily help him in terms of the administration itself. He would have to work at that the same way as everyone else does.
Now, I mentioned that you worked for Bob Hawke when he was Prime Minister. Given that you were a career public servant, how difficult was it to draw a line? Did you ever have to say, sorry, I can't do that, I'm a bureaucrat, not a political appointee?
Not really, for two reasons. First of all, as you know, there's the Member of Parliament Staff Act, which enables public servants on secondment to a minister's office to have greater freedom of movement in terms of the bureaucratic political line. Secondly, the way the Hawke office was organised. While I was the Chief of Staff, there was a political adviser who was of equal rank. And that political advisor, when I first went there, was Jeff Walsh. And the political advisors had direct access to the Prime Minister, and on the nitty-gritty of intra-party politics and some of the more political, with a capital P, that was very much their job rather than mine.
What was that office like to work in? What was Hawke like to work with?
Oh, he was very, very good. He, first of all, worked exceedingly hard, as all prime ministers do. Secondly, he was very comfortable in working from written reports, written briefings, and the like, having been president of the ACTU. And having been a Rhodes Scholar, he had that tradition. I think you'll find, if you talk to people like Alan Gingell, who worked with Paul Keating, I think you'll find Paul Keating had more of a verbal tradition. He liked to get his briefing more through talking and discussion. Hawke did that, but only at the end of reading his briefs. He was meticulous in the way he went through them. The other thing about Hawke is a great capacity to move from one issue to another and give it his total attention. And nowhere was that more exemplified than on the night that Keating challenged him in late May, early June 2001.
This is the first challenge.
The first challenge. Paul Keating came around to the office round about 10 past five. Hawke couldn't see him immediately. He came back impatiently 10-15 minutes later, saw the Prime Minister, advised him what he was doing. From about 6 o'clock that night through to about 1:30 the next morning, Hawke was in his office with senior cabinet colleagues, lobbying and working through what they would do. The next morning at 9 o'clock, there was a scheduled meeting of the Premier's Conference. At 1:30 in the morning, after the Prime Minister and other colleagues had felt they'd done everything they could in terms of Keating's first challenge, Hawke asked for his papers for the Premier's Conference the next morning. And I said to him, look, been a pretty busy day. Why don't you go home and get a bit of rest? You're on top of tomorrow anyway. He said no. He said, I want to really be on top of the material, as I always am. He then stayed in his office from 1:30 in the morning till 3 a.m, going through his papers for the Premier's Conference meeting starting at 9 a.m. in the morning. Think of that. He had been challenged earlier that evening by his Treasurer, which is a pretty big thing if you're Prime Minister and in government. He was able to focus on that and then at 1:30 a.m. completely switch his focus to something else. And he just had that capacity to move from issue to issue. He very much took the view that it was a waste of time to spend emotional energy on that which you could neither control nor significantly influence.
And of course that time he held off the challenge.
He was defeated later in the year. He was.
Now, the other day at the press club, you told a very funny story about your encounter with an earlier Prime Minister. Could you share that with our listeners?
Sure. In the lead up to the 1972 election, Dick Woolcott, who was then my branch head in foreign affairs, came around and said, look, the Prime Minister is speaking at the National Press Club today. He's phoned me up for a game of squash. I've got commitments which I can't get out of. Do you have your squash gear with you? I was the captain of the Foreign Affairs squash team at the time. I said, sure. I thought this was a great opportunity. So I got in the car to race off to the squash court and remembered halfway to the courts that the only T-shirt I had in my bag was an It's Time T-shirt. So I had to quickly go home, change T-shirts. I arrived a little bit late. Prime Minister was a little bit annoyed, but he soon got over that. It was certainly better than turning up with an It's Time T-shirt.
How come you had that It's Time T-shirt?
Well, I was 22 at the time. I was handing out how to vote cards
for Labor.
For the Labor Party in 1972.
Wouldn't be allowed these days.
Well, no, public servants could do that today.
But I bet they wouldn't dare.
Maybe not. I handed out how to vote cards for Labor in 1972, 1974 and 1975. Beyond 75, I was rigorous in not doing anything that could be seen to be party political. I've got to say, the first time I ever handed out how to vote cards for anyone was in 1965 in the New South Wales state election, when I handed out how to vote cards for Premier Bob Askin, who was on the other side of politics. I mean, when you're that age, I mean, you do move around a bit and it's all good fun.
And you gave it up because you'd reached a level of seniority or because it was seen to be not the done thing?
Oh, no, I simply felt that beyond a certain point in the public service, while theoretically you're allowed to belong to parties and allowed to do different things, I felt, you know, if you're going to have the confidence and work in government, you're better off having nothing to do with that side of it.
Before we move on, I should ask you, who won that squash match?
I did. It was unfair. I was 25 at the time. Prime Minister McMahon, I think, was in his early 60s.
And you hadn't learnt the complete art of diplomacy?
No. I had a view when I was 25, the view that I have today, that unless you're playing with little kids, where obviously you should do the right thing. If you're playing with an adult, then you respect them by making them play on merit, not by giving them a freebie. And so I thought about that when I was on the way to the squash court, and I took a deliberate decision that the only points he would win was on merit. But he was a pretty good squash player.
Now, talking about the public service and politics, do you think over recent decades that the public service has become more politicised?
It's a really interesting question, that is. Put it this way, I certainly believe that public servants have the freedom to express their view and provide advice, as I always have. I think some, a minority, but nonetheless some senior public servants in the senior executive service do engage in self-censorship and hide behind a prime minister's temperament or hide behind a minister's temperament in their excuse for not giving the advice they should. I've by and large found prime ministers and ministers amenable to contrary advice. Different ones respond in different ways. Some of them don't like it. However, they'll all accept it. And, you know, I've had a few disagreements with ministers where it's left a bruise for 24, 36 hours. But politicians are very good at moving on. And they move on fairly quickly. I think there's been an element of what has changed. I think the 96 election was the first time that we'd seen so many heads of departments sacked and not given alternative work in government. Now, I know no one's entitled to that, but it's a statement of fact that prior to that, that is the way it had been done. So 96 did mark a watershed. In 2007, the Rudd government took a deliberate decision not to sack senior public servants. They did have a reshuffle 2.5 years later in 2009, and they moved some people on and the like. And then there were further dismissals after the 2013 election. That does reverberate down through the public service. Ultimately, you've got to accept the right of an elected government to have the senior public servants working with them who they feel comfortable with. I think you've got to respect that. However, how you do it is important. And the message, you need to be very conscious of the message that you might be sending in the public service, and you need to be very conscious of the fact that if you're not careful, it can have an impact on some individuals in pulling their punches.
But you have said that despite the problems that public servants may face these days, it's cowardly if they don't...
Absolutely.
Be frank and fearless.
Absolutely. And as I said, the National Press Club, I mean, there's nothing magical in this. In every day of our lives, all of us are exercising judgments about how we engage with someone. If you want a favour with someone, do you just rock up to them or do you take them for coffee? Do you approach them in the morning or do you approach them in the evening? And prime ministers and ministers are people. And providing frank and fearless advice is not about getting something off your chest. It's about seeking to influence for an outcome that you think is the right one.
Do you think in recent times, I guess over recent decades, the public service has become less influential with ministers, partly because they've become more suspicious of it on both sides, partly because the whole advice market has become more contestable with lobbyists and interest groups and so on?
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment in that I think governments now draw their advice from a myriad of areas, academia, think tanks. I mean, go back 40 years and how many think tanks were there in Australia in the national security arena? There are now, you've got the Lowy Institute, you've got ASPE, you've got others who put out very thoughtful papers on a range of issues. So that means the ideas market is richer than what it was, which is a good thing. I don't think public servants should fear that. But quite frankly, Michelle, senior public servants are going to spend more time with ministers and prime ministers than what other people are, simply by the dynamic of government. And they are in a position where they provide formal written advice. So I don't worry too much about the fact that policy advice is now more contested. I think it's a good thing rather than a bad thing.
Now, as you said, most recently you've been head of the Defence Department, so let's turn to some international issues. We know that the Australian-American relationship is much deeper than any particular administration, either there or here. But what is the best way for an Australian government to manage its immediate relationship with a quite capricious president, such as we're seeing at the moment? Should it get close or should it keep a certain distance?
Oh, it should have, it should seek to have an effective professional working relationship. Some people have criticised the Prime Minister for going to the commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Coral Sea with President Trump. I just can't understand that. I think it would have been bizarre for the Prime Minister not to go. The Battle of the Coral Sea was a pivotal naval battle in the Second World War. The US played the decisive part on our side, and why wouldn't you commemorate it? I think Prime Minister Turnbull has done precisely what he should have done in terms of the relationship with the President. Bear in mind that there are other people around the President. We are very lucky in the sense that we have a close, personal, long-term relationship with both the National Security Advisor McMaster, with the Secretary of Defence Mathis. We also know well the Secretary of State Tillerson. So we're reasonably well placed. Trump is obviously very different to his predecessors. He lets it hang out more than his predecessors, and he sometimes wears it on his sleeve more than others. That is just something we need to be aware of, and we're not going to change it. He is, after all, the democratically elected leader of the US, and he's the reality that we interact with.
Because of our long relationship, we have perhaps more resilience than some countries in dealing with an unpredictable administration. But do you think that unpredictability is in fact destabilising for the region?
I think it creates some uncertainty and anxiety. Equally, I think, you know, when it comes to a North Korean issue, it can be both a plus and a minus. I think it'll take a while for countries to get used to the way President Trump operates. But if you dig below that, if you look at the fact that Secretary of Defence Mathis's first overseas visit was to East Asia, it was not to Europe, you look at his consistent messaging there, you look at the fact that Vice President Pence deliberately came to the region, you look at his messaging in Japan, in Korea, and in Australia, I think it's very important not to allow tweets to dominate your perspective of the administration as a whole.
Just going back to your point about North Korea and the plus and the minus factors, can you just elaborate on that?
Well, I think President Trump has been a little bit more robust than some of his predecessors in what he has said about North Korea. I understand that, and I don't think it's a bad thing. I think his directness with the Chinese, I think, is a good thing in terms of North Korea. Equally, it's important to have a consistency of message. You don't want inconsistent messaging on a situation as difficult as that.
How serious is this incident that's dominating the news at the moment about President Trump giving security information to the Russians? And indeed, how much of a worry is this whole relationship with the Russians?
Well, look, the only thing I'd say on that, Michelle, is that you've got a couple of congressional committees that are investigating that. I saw today that the former director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, has been appointed to now head up the FBI, oversee the investigation re-Russia. I know Robert Mueller very well from a long time back. He is a person of immense integrity. He will not allow any political interference in that investigation. And the congressional committees have a long-standing record of not allowing political interference. So one way or the other, whether there's any substance to some of the claims or not, we will get to the bottom of it, but it will take time. It's not something that will unfold over 1 or 2 weeks. It's something that could unfold over a 12-month, two-year period.
It's a pretty messy situation, though, isn't it, when a new president is surrounded by such controversy, so many inquiries. Do you think that President Trump will survive his term?
Look, I don't know. I mean, there have been some people who from day one have been calling for his impeachment, which is bizarre. And I think a fair bit of the media, a lot of the reporting here in Australia, I think has got a bit ahead of itself. Impeachment is a serious business in the US system. Only two presidents have been impeached, Clinton and Johnson back in the mid-19th century, and on both occasions they were subsequently found, I think, not guilty, although they were impeached. And that's not something which a Congress, Democratic control or Republican control, will jump into. And I think a lot of people have just... they are 100 kilometres down the road when they ought to be back at about the 2-kilometre mark.
Now, you have said that we don't always understand the full dimensions of the American-China relationship in all its strength and its complexity. How do you see that relationship playing out over, say, the next 10 years?
Well, first of all, it won't play out in a straight line. There will be occasions when we think it's going badly. There will be occasions when we... I mean, they are strategic rivals. China and the US are strategic rivals. China does aspire to be the dominant military power in the Western Pacific. The US fully understands the fact that China needs room. If you look at the intermix of dialogue arrangements between the US and China, they're infinitely greater than what Australia's are. We sometimes forget that. They have annual meetings. The US and China have annual meetings where they'll have up to 15 or 18 cabinet and sub-cabinet senior officials sitting around the table together. And for Beijing, their single most important relationship is Washington. For Washington, their single most important relationship is Beijing. Neither of them want conflict. They know that both would be the loser in that situation. So how do I see it playing out over the next 10 years? I'd make 2 points. One, it's going to play out over a 50-plus year period, not over a 10-year period. And secondly, I tend to be a glass half full rather than half empty person.
So you think that China, as its great power status grows into an even greater power, will in the long run be a benign force or a belligerent force on balance?
On balance, it'll waver between the two. It is not a good thing that the Chinese have approached the South China Sea in the way they have. They have blatantly snubbed their nose at an international tribunal and its rulings. We should continue to be critical of that. They don't like being called out publicly. We should continue to call them out publicly.
Should we go further, be more activist in that area?
I don't think you can be more gratuitously active. But I think you can do things that remind them of the fact that it isn't forgotten. You can work more closely with some of the ASEANs on it and the like. So, if they were to do more of the South China Sea, I think we would have a great worry. We're just going to have to wait and see.
You've also referred to the activism of China in Australia, yeah. Spying, cyber spying and so on, and also its role over the local Chinese press. Yeah. How much of a worry is this? Obviously, countries spy on other countries, but should we be more concerned than we are about the rise of Chinese influence? We've seen, for example, their role with local politicians even, or their attempted role.
Yeah, look, I've drawn attention to that, really to emphasise the fact that our relationship with China is more complex than what some people pretend. Some people have argued that, China's rising, we've got this great economic relationship with them. Because of that, we ought to be recalibrating our relationship with the United States. And my response to that is, look, a little bit of thought here, please. Yes, the trade relationship is fantastic, economic relationship fantastic. However, China does behave in Australia differently to some other countries. Now, China is perfectly entitled to seek to have a relationship within the Chinese diaspora in Australia. They're perfectly entitled to engage in the activity with the Chinese community here in the same way as the Turkish embassy engages with the Australian Turkish community and the like. However, the Chinese do tend to take a little bit harder line than others when students and others are expressing views contrary to its own view. Its consulates and embassy do engage in organising the community in a way in that I think most people would consider unreasonable. I don't say any of that in terms of seeking to be anti-China. In fact, I've quite the reverse. I was asked at the National Press Club whether I'd work for a Chinese company, and I had no hesitation in saying yes. I mean, the reason being, if China is lawfully investing in Australia and conducting itself in a lawful way, why wouldn't any Australian work for that company if that's what they wanted to do? So it's just that there are many sides to this relationship, and we've got to look at the total picture, not just one part of it.
Looking at another part of the world, you've been Defence Secretary as we've built up a substantial commitment in the Middle East. How do you see that battle with ISIS going, again, in the long run rather than the short run?
Okay. First of all, go back to mid-2014 when ISIS first sort of burst onto the scene in a dramatic way, even though it had been around before then. Military commanders were quite clear in saying it was going to be a good five-year haul. And so far, I think that's the track we're on. If you look at the progress that has made in Iraq, it has been really, really significant. Look where Mosul is, look where Raqqa is in Syria. Slowly but surely, we're getting there. However, over the longer term, the answer is not going to be military. Over the longer term, it's what happens in Iraq is going to be overwhelmingly determined by the capacity of the Iraqi government to be more inclusive than what they have been over the last 10 or so years. It'll be very important for the Iraqi government to come in behind the military to engage in active reconstruction when Mosul, Fallujah and other cities have been taken. Fallujah already has been. It'll be very important for the Sunnis to have a sense of active engagement in their own country's affairs. That is what's going to determine the long-term future of Iraq. Our military involvement can provide a platform, but it doesn't do the whole job.
Now, just before we finish, one question. You've had all these jobs that have been fascinating, high-level jobs. Is there anything else you would have liked to have done that's not on that list?
No. I've been really, really lucky. My first posting was in Nairobi. As a result of that, I wanted to be in a country at the time of independence. So I was in Nairobi 6 years after their independence. So I found myself in Papua New Guinea at the time of independence. That was a goal. I always wanted a posting in Indonesia because Indonesia is just so important to us. And I had that. And then the opportunity to work in a Prime Minister's office, first rate. And I've got to say, I've been really lucky, Michelle, in the sense that this might sound incredible, I've never worked for a bad person. The secretaries I've had.
Perhaps you've been a very tolerant person.
No. I mean, to work, when I was in Prime Minister and Cabinet, people like Mike Codd, I mean, just outstanding.
Who was the head of the department?
Who was the head of the department. And the opportunity to just learn from people like that has been, I've been lucky to have worked where I have worked. And, I've got to be honest. I mean, my career from 9/11 emerged from tragedy. Probably but for 9/11 and but for Bali, I wouldn't have seen as much of Prime Minister Howard. I probably wouldn't have been sent to Washington. So you've got to recognise where the luck comes in. And to have worked for so long with someone like Prime Minister Howard and Prime Minister Hawke, that's pretty good.
Dennis Richardson, it's been fascinating talking with you today. Thank you very much. And thank you to my producer, Elijah Balaj. And that's all from the Conversations podcast for today. We'll be back again with you soon. Goodbye for now.